Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 30109, State v. Alonkus. Arguing for the petitioner, Victor Bakke. Arguing for the respondent, Marissa Looning. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, counsel. And I just want to confirm for the record, although Mr. Bakke had represented the defendant earlier in the case, he wasn't on the CERT application. But I wanted to confirm that there was no objection from the state to his arguing here today. Okay, very well. Mr. Bakke, are you ready to proceed then? Okay, Ms. Looning, you are as well? Okay, so Mr. Bakke, you've reserved 15 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll give you that warning with a light with 15 minutes to go, and Ms. Looning will give you a light with 5 minutes to go. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Justice Reichenwald and members of this honorable court. We are here today to discuss Hawaii Revised Statute Section 707-756, which I have lovingly come to refer to over the years as the Law of Frankenstein. And the reason why I say that is because, like the monster in Frankenstein, the creators of this law had admirable intentions to create something good. There's no question that trying to protect the children of the state of Hawaii from being harmed is an admirable and worthy and lawful purpose of any statute. But, like in Frankenstein, the result of their tampering with the laws that we already have, such as sex assault, attempted sex assault, and use of a computer in the commission of a crime, created a monster. And what they've created, this statute 756, is extremely dangerous. Just like Frankenstein, it's dangerous to all people who cross its path, innocent and guilty alike. So why is this law so dangerous? It's dangerous because it's unconstitutional in the fact that it is vague, overbroad, and violates the Dormant Commerce Clause. And like I indicated, there are already substantial laws in place that can accomplish the same goals that this statute seeks to accomplish without trampling the constitutional rights of the innocent. As the court is aware, the briefs are fairly lengthy and the issues here are extensive, so obviously I don't have the time to go over everything. I'm going to try to just sum up here. First of all, why is this statute unconstitutionally vague? And under the standards, one of the first things is that an ordinary person, we submit, doesn't know what is prohibited the way this statute is written. For example, what does intent to promote or facilitate the commission of a felony mean? And when would a person have to have that intent? Do they have it at the time of the meeting? Do they have to have it at the time of all of the elements? And what is a felony? The statute refers the person to a catch-all, basically referring to the laws of every state, federal, and military jurisdiction in the country.
Don't we have a statute for use of a commission a crime, the use of our felony? Don't we have other offenses that use the term felony?
I believe we do, Your Honor, and the crime, but the problem is, in this case, it's just left to, the problem here is that the catch-all exception, the military, the federal jurisdiction, so I just believe it's a little too vague to expect person of normal intelligence to have to research everything.
I was going to ask the same question that the Chief Justice, and perhaps I was going to ask, but even assuming that's true, does that make the whole statute flawed? I mean, don't we have a lot of cases that redact out flawed portions of the statute?
Well, I think if the court will allow me to go on, because in a nutshell, this whole thing, I believe, Your Honor, can be fixed very simply, which is, the problem we have is this law outlaws communications, and that is just too vague. And if they just simply do what all the other states do, which is put in specific language that is prohibited, it's not constitutionally protected, language that says solicit, induce, entice, things to that effect, then you narrow it down and the person can know what type of felony they would be expected to be.
I thought the only thing that's prohibited in the communication is an agreement to commit sexual activity with a minor. It doesn't target other kinds of conduct, does it?
Well, it actually prohibits in communications with intent to murder the minor also.
For any crime. And that's why I was kind of saying is, if you look, and this comes back to the luring statutes, right? This is not a luring statute because it just talks about general communications. When you look at, and I'm going to read off some of the statutes from other states as examples, they actually create luring statutes. They say it's illegal to entice a minor into committing a sexual act. They just keep it very specific. This just says you can't talk to anyone who pretends to even be a minor about anything if you have the intent to commit any crime or any act that would be a crime under state, federal, military law, ordinances.
Doesn't the statute or isn't one reading of the statute that you have to make an agreement to meet with that intent? So in other words, if we were to interpret the statute as requiring that there be an agreement to meet with the intent to commit a felony involving that child, why does that sweep too broadly?
Because the act, every offense needs an actus reus and a mens reus, and under Black's law definition of actus reus, it says that the actus reus is a wrongful conduct, and there's case law that we cited in our brief to that as well. You can't just go around taking everyday normal activities and then saying, well, but if you do that with the intent to commit a crime, then it's a crime in and of itself. Because at that point, you've circumvented the attempt statutes and you've just gone to strictly punishing somebody based on nothing more than their thoughts. They commit an innocent, everyday act, but they just had a bad thought when they did it.
So under your position, someone could conspire to commit an act of terrorism, go out and buy fertilizer, which otherwise would be a completely innocent act, and that cannot be criminalized because it's criminalizing a completely innocent act based on communications between two or more individuals?
No. It is criminalized already under the attempt statutes. And the attempt statutes afford protection. They say that you can't know somebody's true intent. So you have to look, the law says you have to look at their actions. And their actions, in order to convict somebody at a trial, would have to be strongly corroborative of their intent. And the legislative history in this specifically says, hey, we don't like, the legislature said, we don't like the attempt statutes. It's giving the defendants a way out of this to say, oh, well, I changed my mind or I wasn't really going to go through with it. So they specifically crafted this law to allow it, to disallow attempts. So
hence the travel requirement. You actually, it's not just the state of mind. The law actually requires that the defendant travel to the agreed upon meeting place.
Correct. And
right?
My question to the court would be, does the law require the person to have the intent to commit a crime when they travel? Because I couldn't figure that out from reading it. The way I read it, it says it doesn't.
The question, though, would be if it does have the requirement that there be, when the agreement be made, that the intent be to commit a felony, again, that would be an element of the offense that would have to be shown in every case. So in what way, excuse me, would we be sweeping in otherwise protected conduct if in every case there has to be a showing beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant agreed with a person that the defendant believed to be a minor to meet for purposes of committing a felony? How are we sweeping in purely innocent conduct if that has to be shown in every case?
Well, in this case, for example, the travel doesn't have to have an evil intent with it.
How would the state prove the defendant's state of mind during the time that he was traveling?
The same way they have to prove the state of mind as when they did the communication. You look at the outward acts. And like I said, if you look at the attempt statutes, they require a substantial step in a course of conduct intended or known or intended to culminate in the commission of the underlying offense.
Why isn't traveling to the location equivalent to a substantial step? I mean, you already have to show a communication. You already have to show an agreement with the intent to commit a felony, and you have to show travel.
It could be. A jury could find that that was a substantial step if the person was charged with attempt. But the attempt allows the defense to also argue renunciation. the defendant could walk in and make defense arguments that they're not allowed to, because under this statute, once they show up, that's it.
But that's the legislature's call. I mean, maybe you're right, they could have crafted a better statute, but that's not, we're not here to judge whether they could have, the statutes are more refined or more modern. We have, our judgment is whether or not it's unconstitutional.
Correct. And the second part of the vagueness argument is whether there are sufficient standards included in the written of the law to prevent arbitrary enforcement. And I think you need to read those two together, because at this point, if I pick up the phone right now and I tell my son I'm going to meet you at McDonald's at 2 o'clock and I show up, I've done everything that the statute prohibits except for my intent. So I should be investigated and have to explain what my intent is. I'm subject to arrest because I've electronically communicated with a minor, I've made an arrangement to meet them, and I did show up.
Except you're missing the most important ingredient, essential ingredient of the statute.
Right, but for enforcement purposes, we don't want arbitrary enforcement. And what's key to understand—
Where would probable cause be based on that? Where would there be a reasonable suspicion be? I mean, how could the police stop you or arrest you for calling your son to meet him at McDonald's based on this statute?
Because I met all but one of the elements of the intent. And an officer could say, well, you know what? Well, let me give a different example. Here's a better example. Let's say I want to sell video games on Craigslist. We've got interstate commerce. I've got a legitimate purpose. I want to sell these items. And I start chatting with a 13-year-old. And finally, I make a meeting to meet them at McDonald's. And as that 13-year-old's going out the door, the mom says, where are you going? Oh, I'm going to meet this old guy at McDonald's that I met on the internet. Mom's going to say, no way, you're not going. And she calls the police. And when I show up, guess who I'm going to get met by? I'm going to get met by a police officer instead of the child, because I'm now under suspicion that my intent was to commit a crime. And where I point this out is, if you look at how this law has been imposed and really why this law came to be, is because they copied other jurisdictions. They say, right in the legislative history, this is used as a police investigative tool. And at the time when I filed this thing 5 years ago, I don't know what the stats are now, but at that time, there had been about 35 cases. Every single one of them was a sting operation.
Doesn't that cut against your argument? In other words, there's been no abuse of the statute if all these terrible scenarios that you're painting or postulating, none of them have occurred. Every single one has been with the type of record that's present in this case.
And the reason why I would submit that is because they have to keep this tightly under control in order to make this statute work. If you take it out of that sting operation and apply it to normal everyday activity, you're going to have to investigate. Every mother who says their kid got talked to somebody on the internet and is going to meet them, the police would have to go down and investigate that, because this doesn't work outside of that. I would propose this statute does not work in the real world. It subjects everyone to investigation as opposed to just what they've been doing it with. So I believe since the time is, and I could be wrong, but I believe there's been one or two arrests or cases where it didn't involve the operation, but I'm not familiar with the facts. But at the time, that's the majority of the way this is written. So basically, we have a law that was written for political purposes to just simply try to flesh out people. We have the thought police. They're trying to identify child molesters before they actually—
Should we disallow all sting operations? Or, you know, undercover operations then?
No.
What about undercover drugs?
No. Nope. But they're charged with buying drugs or attempting to buy drugs. They're not charged with making an arrangement with a detective to go down and then buy the drugs, and they actually show up, and then that's it. I really have a problem with the legislative history in this, where they say we're trying to get them for what they did, not what they're trying to do.
And what they're trying to get them for, it says, you know, the purpose of the statute is to, as you say in the other states, is to prohibit luring of minors,
right,
to commit crimes.
The conduct they're punishing is just the It's almost like they've created a new crime of mental attempt. Even though you do something completely innocent, they're trying to say that with the thought, that makes it an attempted crime. If I walk into a bank and I have an intent to rob it, but I get in there and I look around and I change my mind, I can walk back out.
But you have to, the state has to prove the intent beyond a reasonable doubt, right? So in other words, the state can't just say, well, based on the circumstance of having agreed to meet with the child, that's evidence that there was a wrongful intent. They have to have evidence that, in fact, the intent when the agreement was made was to facilitate a felony. So what about that element? Doesn't that provide the protection that you think you're arguing needs to be provided here?
I'm not sure if I follow the question.
Well, my question is, you're suggesting it's a horrible, we're criminalizing large quantities of utterly innocent conduct.
Yes.
And the fact is, if this court were to interpret the agreement to meet element as requiring a felonious intent, there would only be prosecutions and convictions in cases where the state could prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. So they're not going to be innocent people who will be convicted. It'll be people who the state was able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt had that intent.
Right. You know how they'll do that? They'll arrest the guy that's selling the video games, and they're going to charge him, and they're going to bring in Dr. Bivens or someone.
How could they charge him if they have no evidence of intent? They're going to need some evidence of intent. What judge is going to sign a judicial determination of probable cause without some evidence of intent?
Exactly. They will get, like, for example, in the search warrants, you always see in sex assault cases, we're looking for pictures, photographs, whatever, because you're going to get an officer who's going to say, based on my experience and training, child molesters commonly meet children on the internet. They do not discuss sexual or criminal activity. They use other means to get them to the meeting.
Has this happened? Have you had other cases? You do a lot of criminal defense work. Have you had other cases where they try to criminalize benign behavior?
Where they're trying to criminalize benign?
I mean, you're talking about trample constitutional rights of the innocent. That's another question. Is that applicable in this case?
I believe because this statute affects freedom of expression, I believe the facially valid review is the appropriate review. And even in this case, you have, like I said, the legal and factual impossibility of a person communicating with a person that they don't know anything about. So they're referring to, I'm sorry.
Finish your thought.
The police in our case with Mr. Alongus, they're inferring that he had the intent to commit a crime based on the fact that they represented that they were 13. But the statute only requires...
Not just because of the representation, but because of the statements made throughout the communications, correct? That he wanted to have sex with her.
With her.
A 13-year-old.
Because she represented 13. Otherwise, if they had represented that the minor was 17, because the statute says 18 and under. So if she had been 17 and he said he wanted to have sex with her, there wouldn't have been any crime. There wouldn't have been any intent. So that's my other point is there's a conditional intent here almost. You have a person chatting online with a person, and that person says, I'm 13. And this guy says, well, I want to meet you because you want to have consensual sex. But that doesn't mean they're going to commit that crime when they show up. A lot of times they show up because they want to, in fact, verify who they're talking to. No different than adults on Match.com.
But why can't the legislature prescribe it? If the legislature believes that it's contrary to what the legislature believes is appropriate conduct and it should be made illegal, if the legislature wants to say, if you make an agreement to meet with a minor to commit a felony and you travel to that place and they decide to make it illegal, what stops the legislature from doing that?
The problem is the communication. If they would just narrow that down. Because the communications will show, if you limit the communications to enticing, soliciting, inducing, things like that, then that is, like we just said, that's what's evidence of the intent. In Alongus's case, they're basing his intent on the conversations that he had, because the officer recorded the whole thing. But when you put it in the real world, those conversations either one aren't recorded, or two, they don't occur that way. you have a real child molester who grooms people, and that's what the prosecutors are going to do. And the police are going to say, based on our experience and our training, we believe that sex offenders will make arrangements with meetings with children, and they'll make several meetings. They'll groom children over years.
Shouldn't we address that case when it comes to us? If and when it comes to us?
Well, again, I think under the facially valid analysis, we can and should address it today.
How would it ever come to the attention of the court? It's not being recorded. Nobody's reporting it. In this scenario that you have concocted about completely innocent behavior, how would it ever come to the attention of the police? How
like
would
I said,
would your conversation with your son ever come to the, you know?
As soon as the parents or anybody thinks that something is improper. I would call the police if my kid was going down to meet somebody.
And you think that the police wouldn't bother to establish the intent to promote or facilitate commission of a felony?
I'm sorry?
You don't think the police or the prosecutors would try to determine whether there was evidence of intent to promote or facilitate the commission of a felony? Just the fact that somebody
needs they will. And the first thing they'll do is arrest the person, hold them for 48 hours without bail, and try to get a statement from them. That's how the police investigate.
You think there's probable cause based on the mere fact of a meeting with no evidence whatsoever of the felonious intent? Just the fact that a child says, this adult who I didn't know asked to meet with me? That's enough to establish probable cause to commit this offense? That's what you're saying.
Yes, and I believe it's probable cause for arrest. In fact, the JDPC is not filed until after the arrest. So the officer, and that's the whole thing about the arbitrary enforcement of a law enforcement officer on an individual basis. We've only been dealing with the sting operations, but when you put this in and have different officers, they're gonna read that statute and say, hey, and you got the mom saying, you know what, I think he's after my kid.
Based on what? Well, you know, we could argue endlessly.
Right.
I guess the question, I just had one, and we're into your rebuttal time. I had one quick question, and I don't mean to cut you off if you want to keep going by all means.
No,
but you talked about the fact that the so-called catch-all provision in the statute is problematic. That's the part that talks about agreement to commit a criminal offense that is comparable to or exceeds a sexual offense as defined elsewhere. And the ICA found one portion of that overly vague, but it concluded that Mr. Algonquis could not challenge it because that was not the part of the statute that was applied to him, because based on his conduct would constitute, explicitly constitute, if proven, a sexual assault, I think, in the first degree. So why should your client be able to challenge that part of the statute?
Well, because, like I said,
if it doesn't apply,
disagree with the facially valid versus as the applied test.
And why so? If you could explain why we would be doing a facially, why would we be doing a facial review as opposed to an as-applied review in the context of vagueness challenge?
Because it's based on communications. I believe that it affects the freedom of speech and expression.
Are they protected communications? Communications with the child for these purposes, is that protected speech?
It's protected speech.
Speech for the purposes of committing a crime is protected speech?
No. It's speech for purposes of arranging a meeting.
But explicitly for the purposes of creating a crime. We wouldn't be here if that were not the allegation.
Correct. And that's another thing. This statute requires the intent to commit a crime, not the intent to commit a fictional crime. Because in this case, like I said, it's a legal and factual impossibility for Mr. Alongus to have committed any crime. So I think that would be taken into consideration in whether or not we can consider it than Mr. Alongus. But I don't think that Mr. Alongus's test for communications with the minor are akin to yelling fire in the movie theater, I think was the example that was used somewhere in the briefs. And here's the problem. You're talking to somebody that you don't know, okay? So they put in there somebody who's representing. So in reality, is he talking to a child? In reality, is he talking to a child? No, he's not. He's talking to an adult about sex. So does that Does that now make it somehow protected speech? Maybe if you want to say you can't talk to a real child that way, fine. But here, he's talking to a police officer who's simply representing himself. I did just want to point out that, you know, part of the dorm, the ICA kind of blew off the Dormant Commerce Clause argument. But if I can just address that briefly. Yeah. The Dormant Commerce Clause is very, very serious. And in the Pataki case, that's the seminal case, they went through this analysis and, you know, they didn't have the most sympathetic fact pattern in there. They had people that were disseminating pornography to minors. And they said, and that's an inherently harmful activity, I would submit, as opposed to just having a general communication to make a meeting. But even in that case, they said, no, that is okay. You have to allow those types of communications because to do so would basically, if you try to prohibit it, would basically shut down the internet and have all kinds of problems. But then they came in, and the other cases came in and said, however, if it's a luring statute, then we're going to change our analysis and we're going to be much more strict. And it's so easy to make this 756 into a luring statute. We have that with the use of the computer in the commission of a crime. They simply put in there, whoever uses a computer to identify, select, solicit, persuade, coerce, entice, induce, procure, pursue, surveil, contact, harass, annoy, or alarm the victim or intended victim of the following offenses: sex assault in the second degree, sex assault in the third degree, sex assault in the fourth degree. They could have just taken that language and put it in here, and it would have made it a true luring statute. But without that, when you leave it just like vague communications, under the Dormant Commerce Clause analysis, you don't have a luring statute. You have a person sending offensive, maybe, communications to a minor, but they're not going to subject the internet to a patchwork of individual state regulations based on that. So I think the ICA really kind of stopped short on their analysis. And when you look at the way those cases came down, the ones that found things unconstitutional were usually federal civil cases where money was involved. The ones where they found the statutes to be constitutional were criminal cases. And I think I throw that out there for thought as to how we can end up here, because these cases are not sympathetic. Nobody is saying that what Mr. Alongis did should be commended, okay? It's not good behavior. He shouldn't have been doing it. It would have any parent on alarm, but all the laws cover it. And to simply say that what he did is something short of attempt and is some kind of, I would submit, almost like a made-up crime, just for the purposes of trying to get to somebody before they actually do something substantial, we just don't go there. Our system is proactive, not reactive. We say if you have sex with a child illegally, you could go to jail for 20 years. If you attempt to do it, that's fine. If you use the computer, you can do it. But we sit back and we wait until it happens. We don't go out and try to sniff out and identify offenders hoping to come up with, it's almost like profiling. It's saying, you know what, this is what child molesters do. They use the internet, they talk about sex, they make a meeting, and they show up for the meeting. So we're going to go around and try to find people that fit that profile, and then we're going to convict them for meeting that profile, short of them actually doing the intended conduct. Because if that guy shows up and talks with that minor for a little while and then leaves, was there any harm to the minor? And there's something.
Yes. Yes.
And how is that?
You think conversing about a 13-year-old conversing about sexual things with it is not harmful to the minor?
Okay, I'm sorry. Let me take this back. In this case, it was not a minor. It was a person representing themselves to be a minor. I'm sorry. That's what I meant by the profile. And that's why I go back to this thing. It's just been used as a sting operation.
Hasn't the legislature decided that this type of activity is harmful to society, that we do not want people trying to lure minors into sexual activity? Isn't this the legislature's call?
I don't know if they've said that, but it sounds like something they should say. But the problem is that's what an attempt statute is.
So you're saying that there should not be any conviction unless there's an actual attempt, the police would have to wait to have an actual 13-year-old and to allow the sexual contact to proceed before an arrest could be made. That would be the only way the legislature could criminalize this type of behavior.
I think the way the law is written now, yes, because it's too unconstitutional. But again, I don't think we have to come in here and say that child molesters should be rewarded. Just simply change it so that communication is narrowed to prevent exactly what we're all saying it's meant to do, which is to prevent people from trying to lure. This doesn't say that. This just says you can't communicate with anybody with this vague intent. And here's something I propose. I don't know if this is a matter of first impression for the court, but the actus reus and mens reus that go together, I couldn't find anything in Hawaii that says really about the actus reus. I don't know if it's a carryover from before the model penal code or what, but you know, I would argue to the court that if you're going to have an actus reus, you need some type of overtly improper or harmful conduct. And then you have to match that with the mens reus. There's other case law in other jurisdictions that say pretty much that.
Well, Mr. Buck, you know, you've now gone through your rebuttal time and you're in your oral argument time is actually up. So, you know, I don't want to cut you off, no, and I will give you some time in rebuttal since we've asked a lot of questions during this period, but perhaps at this point, unless you have something else that you want to raise now, why don't we hear from Ms. Lenig, and then I'll give you a brief rebuttal at the end.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Deputy Solicitor General Marissa Looney, appearing on behalf of the State of Hawaii. I'm very pleased to be appearing before you this morning to defend the constitutionality of our state's electronic enticement statute, which is an important law enforcement tool in protecting children against sexual predators. There are three main issues that I wanted to speak with you about today. The first is that the statute is not unconstitutionally overbroad because it does not purport to and actually does not attempt to regulate activities that are protected by the First Amendment. Any speech involved in violating the electronic enticement statute is considered speech integral to criminal conduct, and that lies outside the protection of the First Amendment. Second, this particular defendant does not have standing to bring a vagueness challenge to the validity of the statute because, one, the statute doesn't reach a substantial amount of constitutionally protected conduct, and two, the statute is not vague as applied to him. Finally, the statute does not violate the Dormant Commerce Clause. It does not affect legitimate commerce, and it does not attempt to regulate interstate trade. Crucial to an understanding of the state's vagueness and overbreadth arguments is a discussion of the scope of the statute, that is, what does it cover? Because if the court agrees with the state that there is no constitutionally protected conduct, including free speech or free association implicated by the statute, then both the defendant's facial vagueness and overbreadth challenges must fail. This is because in a facial challenge to the overbreadth and vagueness of a law, a court's first task is to determine whether the enactment reaches a substantial amount of protected conduct. If it does not, the overbreadth challenge must fail. The court should then examine the facial vagueness challenge and, assuming that the enactment implicates no constitutionally protected conduct, should uphold the vagueness challenge only if the enactment is impermissibly vague in all its applications. So, a plaintiff who engages in some conduct that is clearly prescribed cannot complain of the vagueness of the law as applied to others.
What about Beltran?
Well, in Beltran, there was actually, the court found that constitutionally protected behavior was involved in the statute, and Beltran, the camping ordinance did not require a mens rea, and this statute.
I mean, didn't it permit the defendant to challenge it, even though it didn't directly affect the defendant?
Right, because a substantial amount of constitutionally protected conduct was involved. So when there is a substantial amount of constitutionally protected conduct involved, a facial challenge is permitted.
The ICA looked at some of the language of the statute and then basically said the defendant couldn't challenge it. What's your argument regarding if we were to apply Beltran to the language of comparable and exceeds?
Well, I don't think that this court should reach that issue because there's no protected speech involved in this case. So
this is a vagueness. I'm talking about vagueness.
Right, but if there's no constitutionally protected conduct, then Village v. Hoffman Estates teaches that you should only uphold a vagueness challenge if the statute is unconstitutionally vague in all its applications. So you necessarily have to look at defendant's conduct in order to determine if a statute is impermissibly vague in all of its applications.
Well, how does this differ, the present case differ from Beltran?
Well, Beltran had no mens rea requirement to violate the ordinance.
Besides that? It's as far as the vagueness application.
Well, there was, in Beltran, the camping definition was so broad that it ensnared constitutionally protected activity. And in this case, there's no constitutionally protected activity involved because the speech involved is speech integral to criminal conduct. It requires, it's not a pure speech case. This statute only criminalizes speech plus certain conduct and has an intent requirement built into it.
How would I know if I was a member of the public what was a criminal offense that was comparable to or exceeds a sexual offense as defined in paragraphs 1-5? I mean, isn't that asking a little bit much of the member of the public?
I don't think that either of those terms are constitutionally infirm. I disagree with the ICA's.
But you did not file a cert app. The state did not.
I did not because technically I think that was dicta because it was not essential to the holding of the case. Because as the ICA went on to conclude, he cannot bring a challenge to the vagueness of the statute because the statute is clearly valid as applied to him. But comparable to, I think, is, as the ICA found,
Let's back up. I'm sorry, in this case, does the catch-all, I'm calling it the catch-all provision, so that's the comparable to or exceeds. Is that what this prosecution proceeded under, or did it proceed under some other theory?
The comparable to or exceeds language is not necessary for a conviction against Alonquez, and it's not, his conduct was specified under a different part of the statute. In 846E1, it specifically says that sexual assault in the first degree and sexual assault in the third degree are specifically prohibited. And his stated intent was, or defendant's stated intent was to have sex with two 14-year-old girls. And that is consistent with the offenses of sexual assault in the first degree and sexual assault in the third degree. So
this prosecution was not premised on the so-called catch-all provisions that But why can't he, if we were to conclude, as the ICA did, that those provisions were in some way suspect, why can't this defendant raise it? Why shouldn't he be allowed to raise it, or why is that not good policy to allow us to address something that on its face seems problematic?
Well, the case law from both this court and the United States Supreme Court are very clear that that in order to have standing, to challenge the constitutional validity of a statute, a person must show that, as applied to him, the statute is invalid and constitutional rights cannot be vicariously asserted. So even if theoretically or hypothetically the exceeds or comparable to language was vague as to some defendant that's not before the court at this time.
But how is he supposed to know that, you know, the counts that he was charged with were, the state does charge with intent to promote the facilitate the commission of a felony that is an offense defined in Section 846E1 of the Hawaii Revised Statute. So how is he supposed to know which subsection you're going under?
It's actually, I think, not necessary. I think this court's held to specify which crime, under State v. Robbins, if a crime requires only an intent to commit an underlying offense, then the underlying offense itself need not be specified in the indictment. So, that's my answer. But I do disagree that the exceeds language is vague because it still describes a criminal act. It has to be an offense that exceeds one of the enumerated listed acts in 846E1.
How exceeds in what sense?
Well,
is it the act that exceeds? Is it the punishment that exceeds? What are we talking about?
That was the question that the ICA had. And actually, this court can, if it chooses to reach that issue, define what is meant by the word exceeds.
What does the legislative history say?
I do not believe that the legislative history addressed that because it was following the language of the Jacob Wetterling Act. It was following federal guidelines so that, you know, you can receive federal money. But this court can narrow the meaning of the word exceeds so that in future cases, if there were some defendant who was being charged or whose conviction relied upon the exceeds language, so that their due process rights were not violated. But in this case, because his stated intent was consistent with sexual assault in the first degree or sexual assault in the third degree, that language is not necessary for his conviction.
Now, a few moments ago, you said there were Hawaii cases that say in order to bring a vagueness challenge, the defendant has to be directly affected by the provision that's being challenged. What cases were you citing?
State v. Marley, State v. Manzo, State v. Sturge.
Okay, and did the Beltran case in some way overrule those cases, though, or change the doctrine to allow a more expansive challenge on the basis of vagueness?
I think the State v. Beltran was relying on some language from Colinger v. Lawson in a footnote, but it said that you could bring a facial challenge if a substantial amount of constitutionally protected conduct was at issue. And that's not the case here. So if there's no constitutionally protected conduct at issue, then the regular standard applies, which is that you can't bring a constitutional challenge on behalf of another person.
But Mr. Bakke says this statute's all about communications. There's all kind of communication taking place that could be picked up by this statute. So why is there not an effect on First Amendment rights?
Just because words are used to violate a criminal statute does not bring it within the protection of the First Amendment. And yes, this a violation of the statute necessarily involves speech, But defendant cannot be convicted just based on speech alone. The police didn't go into his house and arrest him based on what he was saying to the detectives online, whom he thought were young girls. No one would be arrested just based on speech alone. There also has to be an intent to commit a specified felony, and there has to be an agreement, a travel to the agreed upon meeting place at the agreed upon time. So it's not just speech or communication that makes this a crime. There has to be more. So, because there's no constitutionally protected behavior involved, an overbreath challenge must fail. Because in order for there to be a successful overbreath challenge, there must be a substantial amount of overbreath. And here, where there's just no First Amendment conduct at issue, there cannot be a successful overbreath claim.
You know, the Robbins case that you said says you don't have to specify the underlying offense. Is that from this court?
The statute is, citation is 66 Hawaii 312.
Thank you.
And again, the statute is not vague as to Mr. Alonkis because the statute gave him fair notice that communicating with whom he thought was a 14-year-old child and agreeing to meet them with the purpose of engaging in sex with them was prohibited. So the statute is not vague as applied to him. And as to his dormant commerce clause challenge, the claim is just completely without merit. The Pataki case that he relies upon is very easily distinguishable because it made a defendant guilty by mere transmission of materials. And it specifically stated in that case that it was not a challenge to the luring aspect of the statute. And this, contrary to defendant's assertions, is a luring statute. And guilt is not predicated merely upon transmission of materials or communication. There still has to be an intent to promote or facilitate the commission of a specified felony and then actual travel to the agreed upon meeting place.
Was Pataki a federal district court case?
Pataki, yes, it was from
New York.
It's not binding.
Southern District of New York.
Even if the statute did regulate commerce, which it does not, it would easily pass the Pike v. Bruce Church test because any effects on commerce would be incidental in relation to the substantial benefit to the state that the statute provides. Does the court have any more questions?
Are there any other questions? Thank you very much, then. Mr. Bakke, your rebuttal. No rebuttal? Very well. The court will take this matter under advisement. Thanks to our counsel on both sides for your arguments today.